On the podcast today, we have Dr. Brinelli Hoyle. Welcome, Brinelli.
Thank you.
Am I saying that right?
Yeah, you're saying that perfectly, actually.
Before we get started, I just want to acknowledge that I'm producing the podcast on the stolen territories of the Kalaman, Komox, Homoko, and Klehus First Nations. Grateful to be here. All right, so Brinelli, I want you to tell me a little about yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So, hi, I'm Brinelli Hoyle. I have been a BCBA for 10 years almost at this point. Been working in the field. I started out as a special educator, and now I've been working in the field across lots of different settings, schools, clinics, group homes, adult services, and more recently teaching for a university as well. So, you know, that's basically a little bit about me and how I got in, or what I'm doing now in the field, essentially.
Let's take it back further. So you said you were a special educator before. So how'd you get into special education in the first place?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So I, my elementary education was in India. And so special education was always something I just was always drawn to, just realizing how much there is a lack of support for students who struggle academically. And, you know, growing up in a country other than here, there's definitely a different approach to education and a lot more punishment based, if I may say. And, you know, I'm sure it's come a long way at this point. I wouldn't know specifically from direct experience how much further it's come along, but special education was something I was always drawn to. So when I moved here, I decided to go to school and do my undergrad in special ed and become a special education teacher while I was working as a paraprofessional for a private school that serviced children with autism. And then beyond that, the interest just grew in behavior analysis, just because I liked the research part of it, like the systematic approach to it, and how the behavior change can be so positive. So I just continued to pursue that career path. Because
so how long were you? So you were a special ed teacher?
I was a special ed teacher from 2005 till about, well, even when I started working at a private school, I was still under a special ed teacher category. So even though I was working more in a one-to-one, I was still the classroom teacher, essentially. Mm-hmm. But I worked, and initially I worked in a high school, and I taught 8th and 10th grade science and math in special ed resource classrooms. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah.
First experience as a special educator.
And you said you're a paraprofessional before that. Was that in the US or in India?
That was in the U.S. Yeah. Oh, so yeah. I never worked in, I moved here when I was 14. So I was still in high school. Yeah. So I never had like any work-based experience, but I used to tutor a lot when I was in India. So I had a few students that had academic challenges that I would tutor in the school setting. So always something that interested me, just how people learn. It's just something I was always interested in.
Why did you move here? Like 14, that's an interesting age to come over.
That's a good question. You know, back then it wasn't really like a choice. We were told that, you know, this is where the family is moving. And I knew like 2 weeks before we were moving.
Wow.
That moving to the U.S.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it was my siblings, myself, my parents. We already had family here.
Okay.
So, which was the reason for coming over. And, you know.
Gotcha.
That mass immigration is continuously happening. I mean, the population of Indian Americans now has like tripled since we moved here in 95. So, it's a big population of Indian Americans now.
Gotcha.
First generation, even. Yeah.
So what part of India were you in when you grew up?
I was in Gujarat. So it's like near Delhi, like that area. I don't know how much you know about India in general, like
a little bit.
State to state, it looks very different.
Yeah, yeah.
Different languages being spoken, food is different, religious practices look different. So there's, you go from one part to another, it's very different.
And so where you were, what was sort of the main language and sort of the dominant religion?
Yeah. So where I was, the dominant religion was definitely Hinduism and Muslim religion as well. But and then main language spoken was probably like Gujarat. The main language is Gujarati, but mostly he also speaks Hindi because you have to take three languages from like second grade on. So you have to take English, your native language of the area you're from, and then you also have to take Hindi. I grew up always speaking three languages because I had to, basically.
Random question that I always think of after the fact and never think to ask in the moment. Remember life, actually, because I had Hindi friends, and I don't know why I never asked this question. But so Hindi is the religion. Hindi is the language. Mm-hmm. I've never heard of, and maybe it's just because the words sound the same to me, and this is just a clueless bias question. But what's the sort of the connection of the language to the religion? Or is there one? Or is it just a coincidence that they both have Hind in it?
Yeah, I think it's more, I mean, I'm sure there's history that I probably don't know of why those two words are very similar. Yeah. Like Hindi as a language has existed for such a long, thousands and thousands of years. So is Hindu as a religion.
Right.
So I know the Indus Valley is where it really all comes from and stems from. But like Hindi as a language. The scriptures in Hindu religion are in Sanskrit. It's not in Hindi.
Right.
So it just makes no sense. I think like Indian people just love languages in general. Which is why we have so many dialects and, you know, so many different ways of communication, I guess.
And here's another random question. Again, you don't have to know the answer to this. I'm not expecting you to, but if you happen to, that'd be cool. So I've been doing a lot more sort of kind of my work, not work, but sort of trying to collaborate and bring on folks that are that kind of identify as Indigenous. And for the most part, that's, you know, been folks kind of on Turtle Island, which we call North America. But, you know, I have been learning more and more, a little more about sort of, and it shouldn't be surprising, but that, you know, there's obviously there's Indigenous people everywhere. Like everywhere had people originally at some point. It's not always the people that are there. Like, for example, I was learning about the Sami people in northern Norway. They're sort of a, you know, many thousands of year old Indigenous group that sounds really cool. I know they do a lot with reindeer. There's a lot more to it, but reindeer farming is a big sort of part of what they do. But they're kind of, you know, and again, I know so little about them and I really need to learn some more. I want to see if I can, I'm trying to get someone on, but you know, they're white presenting. Right. And so, you know, the idea of the concept of an Indigenous person being white, I think, is very foreign to us white folk over here. Right. But of course, white folks were Indigenous to somewhere at one point. Right. You know, and so I've been trying to sort of just do more exploration on kind of the concept of indigeneity and, you know, and try to sort of find folks from, you know, more relatively unknown Indigenous groups. So that all being said, are you familiar with sort of the Indigenous people of India? You know, would you all be Indigenous? You know, as your family or whatever. More so, just because you mentioned thousands of years, I'm just sort of curious how far back things go and that kind of thing. Do you know anything about that at all?
That's fair. That's a, you know, and my husband, who's a history teacher, probably knows more than me. Who actually grew up there. So, which is why I married him, because he knows parts that I don't know. But I mean, as far as like my personal family culture goes, like it does date back hundreds of years. Like the home that we own there is over 200 years old. But like, I know as far as like Indigenous goes, I know as far as like the caste system, as like we're considered like the Brahmins, which is like the highest caste, and But like, as far as like true Indigenous people, you know, before like the British colonized us, I'm sure the caste system definitely existed even back then. Like, yeah. Then. So
yeah.
Who came first in those things? I probably wouldn't know that information.
Yeah.
I probably do my own research to find that out too.
I had someone on recently who is Romani. And she was telling me that, interesting enough that, and again, I'm by no means expecting you to know everything about India and its history and everything. I mean, obviously there's so much, and there's so much variety in India itself.
Yeah.
But she was just telling me that, like, I had no idea that the Romani people originated in India.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Really interesting. And I think it was somewhat connected to the caste system as for why they left. I think they were trying to, it was almost like they were draft dodgers of the caste system. that was part of the reason they kind of got out of there. But there's more to it than that. But if you're planning on collecting continuing education credits for this episode, you'll need to enter the three secret words at www.cbiconsultants.com/shop. The first secret word is Zen. You're BCBA now, behavior analyst now. So when did you find behavior analysis? Like in the school setting? Like did someone come in and they were practicing it, or like how did you find it?
Yeah, so this was, I mean, this goes back to 2001, which is when I first took a job as a paraprofessional in a private school. And that's when they were practicing behavior analysis. And mostly it was, you know, the early on, I think most of us learned about behavior analysis through discrete child teaching, which was my exposure to behavior analysis at first as well. It's definitely come a long way, and I'm happy to see the changes that are being made across the field. But, you know, that was definitely my first exposure, is watching discrete child teaching with children on the autism spectrum and with developmental disabilities. And just the way the session looked and how systematic it was. And then you had data to show, like, within that session, what occurred? Like, what did you do and how did they perform? Like, it was an immediate information right there for you. Like, you didn't have to wait 4 or 5 months to see this progress report of this child.
Yeah.
Figure out how they were learning or if they were learning anything, for example. Just immediate fascination with that, because I'd never seen anybody learn that way ever.
Right, right. Cool. And where was this? So what state were you in?
This is, so I'm still in New Jersey. So this is a private school in Montclair area. That was my first exposure to behavior analysis assessment. And back then, I think we had, I mean, now we have over like, 40,000 BCBAs. Back then it was probably in the hundreds, I'm sure. Even the certification, I don't think, was as prevalent.
No. And someone told me recently that New Jersey, maybe not the highest, but one of the highest concentration now of BCBAs, and that's something to do with insurance, I think, and which absolutely. I don't know much about, but there's a ton there, so it's not surprising that you were exposed to it there.
By far, is where I've seen the most. I mean, New York is the second closest, I would say, and Massachusetts, but it's surprising, like how I also think like New Jersey's like so densely populated. I think it makes sense why services are available a lot faster. Yeah. There's not as many rural areas necessarily. I'm sure, and they're still don't have service. I have a friend who runs a company down in Cape May, and I don't know how well you know New Jersey, but like Cape May is about 3 hours from here,
right?
From where I live, I'm much closer to the city. So like my area certainly has services available like every couple miles. You'll see a clinic, home, ABA service company. Whereas you go down to like Cape May area and there's like one or two, even still now. So
I was gonna actually ask about that. It's interesting you led into that, because I was wondering about sort of what it's like in the rural areas. I had Rocio Rosales on way back, and yeah. She was talking about, she's in Massachusetts, and which also has just, I think she was suggesting that Massachusetts might have the highest density of behavior analysts, mm-hmm. But that in rural Massachusetts, there's no services at all. And you know, it sounded much as if she was like, you know, heading down to South America to provide services in some, you know, community. But she was just sort of driving, you know, a few miles down the interstate, and folks are just mm-hmm. struggling. So it's interesting just how that all works.
I know. It's interesting, like the location of where you are determines how much services is available.
Yeah.
Because insurance is insurance. I don't know why that matters, but yeah. It seems the closer you are to like a more metropolitan area, like we're very close to New York. So I'm sure that's a factor as well. Yeah.
So, okay. So now you work mostly in, you said schools, group home, adults. So you're not much of an early intervention work person, or?
I did that. I actually did that when I was completing my undergrad, when I was finishing up becoming a teacher. I did that for a little bit before I took a teaching position. And then I went back to it when I was in my master's. So I did early intervention like here and there. And it was also another exposure to like a different side of ABA, because back then it was more... they called it something else, and I can't remember, but it mirrored a lot of like floor time. They used to call it like floor time method, but it wasn't really. It's more, you know, just using techniques of behavior analysis, but calling it something else essentially. But yeah, so I worked in early intervention like sporadically, I would say, throughout my career early on, and then now I don't do early intervention currently, but I do have a lot of young learners, like ages 2 to 5 learners, which is also interesting. The nice thing I loved about early intervention is I had more exposure to children who weren't just on the spectrum. I also had like a lot of medically fragile children here and there. So that was an interesting aspect to see like how these interventions generalized across different populations.
So what would be a medically fragile child? What's that mean?
So I had this was years and years ago. I remember I had a learner who was on a feeding tube and wheelchair bound, and also had developmental delays. Doing that assessment, like I clearly needed support when I was doing that assessment, but when I did that assessment, I had to approach it a little bit differently. There were definitely skills that were not going to be addressed or necessary to be addressed. Just needed to look at quality of life and what can we do to make this person as independent and capable of, you know, self-management as much as possible, and what is going to be their quality of life for the rest of their life. What is, you know, because even with some students with medical fragility, like some of the schools I've worked in, I haven't only worked with population with autism too, so I've tried to like, you know, get little bit more exposure. Like currently one of the schools I consult for, it's medically fragile students with cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, and not just developmental disabilities. And it's kind of cool to see how these principles work and can happen outside of just autism, using the same principles and same procedures, but just modifying it to the population that you're servicing. It's kind of cool to watch.
Is there much or even any kind of research in that area, like in you know, with working with that those populations? I mean, I've seen a little bit on Down syndrome for sure.
Yes.
Well, that's the only one really.
I've definitely seen it more on Down syndrome and those areas, but not as much with like students with cerebral palsy, for example. I'm not seeing as much. And again, like it might just be that it's not an area that I'm researching. So that I'm close to it, or I don't know if I'm not doing the research, or is it that doesn't exist? I know the Journal of Developmental Disabilities definitely produces more research across different neurodiverse individuals compared to like just autism.
Right.
But, you know, it's, so sometimes when I do my consult, I do have to do a little bit of research. Like if I have a student who's deaf and blind, that's very new to me. I've had some exposure to that, but not necessarily when they're above the age of 10.
Yeah.
I have to do a little bit of research on my own to see like, okay, what can we teach this person? Functional communication is always the first thing that we target. And then where do we go from there? Like how far can we actually feasibly teach this person? And what are the most important things that we're going to teach?
Yeah, I had a behavior analyst that specializes in deafblind kids on Siobhan Sutter. She's actually in, you're talking about Vegas. I think she's actually in Nevada. And as she was, if I could recall, she was saying that there's a lot of these sort of state deafblind programs, I guess. And they're all over the place. But the one she's in, well, there's a behavior analyst and it's her. and so that's
the other thing. A lot of these places, it's more of a therapeutic approach. So you don't always see behavior analysts being involved in those areas. Yeah. There's more speech, PT, and, you know, the treatment is much more led by those folks. But, it's kind of nice where my consult is very limited with the school that I'm with, but you know, it's nice for me to be exposed to that and see like, what is the OT working on where we can implement some behavior analytic interventions to support this individual and increase their response. And, you know, see like how much more progress we can make with some important procedures in place, basically.
Yeah. Siobhan Sutter, look her up. She wants more behavior analysts to reach out to her.
I will absolutely reach out to her because I definitely have students that I can use her help with.
And then just, I was thinking about sort of medically fragile folks and for those listening, someday I'm going to publish video and you'll be able to see this book, but right now only Pranali is going to see it. Do you know this book? It's a great one. Yeah, actually edited by some Canadian behavior analysts, but it talks about it's got a chapter on Fragile X, a chapter on Down, a chapter on Smith-McGinnis, Williams Syndrome, Angel One Syndrome, Greater Willie. Genetic Syndromes and Applied Behavior Analysis, a handbook for ABA practitioners. Folks who might be familiar with Brock University in Ontario.
Yes.
Dorothy Griffiths and Rosemary Kondalak, who are Dorothy's still there, but I think Rosemary kind of runs that program there. And she wrote that book.
Have to order that.
Get to it. And then I had a great guest who Nicole Neal, also in Canada, Western University, and all she does is research ABA and Down syndrome, and it's a lot of cool stuff going. So she's another good one. All right, so for folks listening, they're like, but the title of this podcast says either mindfulness or meditation. We'll see as we get there. When are you going to talk about that? So how'd you get into this area? This was your dissertation, your doctoral dissertation was on mindfulness and play skills and that sort of thing. So how did you come to want to do a dissertation in this area?
So, I mean, I have to thank my doctoral program for allowing me to do research in this area, because there's clearly not a lot of behavior analytic research in this area. I mean, it's getting more prevalent, but I have to say it's still lacking. There's a lot more like group-based research for sure. Not as data-based. So I wanted to, one mindfulness approach, you know, the underlying historical evidence of mindfulness through the Buddhist religion, I've always admired. Just because I grew up learning some of that, because Buddha himself was a Hindu. He was a man who followed the Hindu religion.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then Buddhism came, and a lot of the things within Buddhism reflects a lot of Hinduism, but it goes beyond some of the other factors that Hinduism considers, like the, you know, like the mindfulness approach does have some groundwork in Hinduism too, in some of our Vedas and the books that have been published. So so I always liked those aspects of it from very early on. My parents, you know, are very religious, but they, you know, we do a lot of chanting and things like in the Hindu religion, like there's a lot of that, just naturally, the sound of bells. And so the sound of the bell always brings a lot of calmness to me, just naturally.
Yeah, I think
a lot of that is like experience through childhood, and like positive experiences that I've had have been around that. And it's like correlating with like family gatherings and happy experiences. So there was just natural curiosity. And then I took a course in my doctoral program on mindfulness, because I was curious about like the application of it clinically and how we can further that research, and became even more interested. And I was lucky to have a team of professors who were very encouraging and letting me kind of take it to the next level. You know, typically in some universities, you have to keep your topic very much related to autism, or the participants that I had in my study, none of them had developmental disability. They were neurotypical children, but also had some underlying factors, you know. And due to privacy, I can't talk about that necessarily, but, you know, they had some underlying factors. But the purpose of the study was more for parent training purpose rather than looking at the child.
Gotcha.
How can reduction in stress and anxiety for the parent lead to positive outcomes?
So you weren't doing any mindfulness meditation with the kids themselves. It was all the parents to sort of, you know, help them sort of be, you know, more effective.
Yeah.
Parents and so on and so forth. So what's I mean, you've already touched a bit about sort of Buddha and that sort of thing. Like, was mindfulness around, like, how far back does it go? Like, you know, was it long before Buddha, and Buddha was just the guy that kind of said, let's spread the love?
Goes beyond that. Yeah. Like, I mean, thousands and thousands of years. I mean, it dates back to a lot of the Sanskrit texts, even in the Hinduism, talks about like some of the terms that that are used in the Buddhist aspects of mindfulness. Like, so it does date back, and, you know, I'd have to do more of that historical research to see how far it dates back. But, you know, it's definitely not a new concept, but I think it's become a new concept because the Western civilization has adapted it incorporated it within treatment for anxiety and chronic pain. And John Kabat-Zinn was definitely the first person to really bring it to that Western culture.
Yeah. Okay, I'll get to him in a second. But before it got over here.
Yeah.
Like, you've talked about it sort of being used in sort of, you know, Hindu kind of religious practices. And I think it's probably used in a few other religious practices as well. Was that essentially mostly what it was used for, or like, or was it sort of a, you know, was it used? I mean, I know sort of the concept of therapy and all of that stuff is a very kind of colonial, kind of westernized thing, and so I'm learning more and more that, you know, there's not much information on sort of the history of therapy in other countries, because people just weren't doing therapy because it what, you know, and you know, you know, and, you know, something you and I were chatting sort of before we hit record, about, I had a guest on yesterday, Rihanna Robinson. She's an Indigenous professor in kind of my home province and studies disability in sort of Indigenous communities. And she was talking about kind of this sort of idea of an Indigenous model of disability, sort of as we're, you know, when we think about sort of medical models and social models. And the core sort of element of the Indigenous model of disability is that in Indigenous communities in North America, Turtle Island, there's no such thing as deficit-based thinking. Mm. So when someone has, you know, a disorder or, you know, a physical ailment or something, and you'll notice I'm avoiding using the word disability because she talks a lot about disability being this Western construct as well.
Yeah. So,
you know, just because you have a broken arm doesn't mean you have a disability. The disability is your, is how you fit in the sort of society, or how society, you know, decides how you fit or whatever. So anyway, so it was this sort of, and a lot of these Indigenous guests I've had on are talking about this sort of deficit discourse. And this is why, you know, I had some really cool Indigenous psychologists on that talk about how, you know, Western psychology just doesn't work for, you know, on the reserve because it's that deficit focus right away. And so I imagine in, you know, in countries like, you know, India and others, you know, they're anywhere, like, if you go back in history, that, you know, if there's probably some similar thinking around that. And so there's a long-winded way of trying to sort of ask if, you know, mindfulness was sort of used sort of outside of religion, you know, to help with other things. Did you know anything about that? Or
yeah, I mean, that's another area where I feel like that's where I would like to continue that research. Like, what was it used for? Like, right now, the most, when I did my research, or at least when I started doing the lit research, a lot of it was found within that Buddhist context and within that religious concept.
Yeah.
And which is why it gave that opportunity to have that Western definition that talks about more of it from a therapeutic approach. But I think mindfulness itself, or that component of it, was always a therapeutic thing before Western civilization recognized it as a therapeutic thing. So I don't think it was necessarily like now it's being used therapeutically because we have research. I think it was just always being used that way.
But
because of that religious context and that wanting to remove that religious context, because it can be uncomfortable, I guess,
in
some aspects. But I mean, like, mindfulness can be, it doesn't have to be just sitting down and doing meditation, right? Because it's a mind. It's not necessarily action that you're doing.
Right.
So there's definitely a lot of talk about that in the Hindu scriptures and the Buddhist scriptures.
And I suppose also, you know, in a place like that where, you know, folks are essentially growing up doing mindfulness all the time, you know, even the idea of sort of, you know, intervention and therapy is in some ways a very kind of reactive, you know, you now have a mental illness, so we need to, you know, do some, you now have, you know, severe anxiety, so let's get some mindfulness practices going to kind of help you with that. Whereas I imagine, you know, it'd be interesting to look at sort of the, you know, things like the prevalence of anxiety and whatnot in some of these countries where, you know, mindfulness is sort of always been there. And so if you're always doing mindfulness, it's probably safe to say that you're less likely to be, you know, super anxious all the time and, you know, maybe have some of these mental illnesses and whatnot. I mean, obviously I don't know that for a fact, but, and so there would never be a need for, okay, step up the mindfulness this week because you're losing your grasp on reality or whatever. So
No, absolutely, I completely agree with you on that. I think that those are like two sides of a coin. It's like, what, you know, whether we look at it as a therapeutic approach, it's still something that always existed. And I think and that's the part, like, where I would still like to look at it much further is like, what can be, I mean, I, like, my kids do have done mindfulness since they were little. I have a 9-year-old who meditates before his basketball games And very much see a difference the days that he does the meditation in his performance and his reduction of his, some of his anxiety, like just getting on the court and playing the game. So it's not one of those, like, let's do mindfulness to reduce anxiety. Let's just have that be part of your daily repertoire.
Mm-hmm.
And don't think of it as like, I'm doing this to reduce anxiety. I'm doing this just to be within myself and in this present moment.
Yeah.
Just think of it that way rather than constantly think of it as like reducing something.
Because anxiety is just, you know, in its simplest form, is just not being in the present moment.
Right. Yeah. The inability to shut your brain off, essentially, and the thoughts that are the wandering thoughts and the constant perseverance on certain topics. So whatever it is that brings on anxiety for you.
Yeah.
It's literally just taking all that away, letting it occur and not having effect everything around you.
Maybe let's get into some sort of definition. So mindfulness, meditation, are they the same thing?
So those are not the same. And I think that that's where the confusion happens a lot, is that people, or at least, you know, at least based on some of the research, it seems like mindfulness gets equated with meditation. Whereas mindfulness is, has not, you know, it can be, meditation could be a way to achieve mindfulness, but it doesn't mean that's the only way. So like there's walking meditation. I mean, just being in the present moment. So like the example I always use is like, one of the things I do is like, I love to do dishes, and I engage in mindfulness while I'm doing dishes. I'm only thinking about the dishes, how the water feels, and you know, how the soap feels on my hands. So, or like if I'm eating a really good meal, I'm only thinking about what are the different tastes in my mouth and how that like is affecting my body. Like, is it changing my mood? Like, for me, that's mindfulness. I don't like, I will sit and meditate in the morning for a few minutes, and I will do that right before I go to bed. It just helps me start my day that way. And it's part of my routine at this point. But, you know, I try to do present moment awareness, essentially sustained attention to whatever I'm doing at that moment.
And so present moment awareness is just kind of, and you talked about John, what's his name? John Kabat-Zinn?
Yes.
Or how do you pronounce that middle name? Kabat?
Is it Kabat? Yeah.
Kabat-Zinn. Yeah. And I remember I got his book, was it Wherever You Go, There You Are, I think it's called? Which, and this was, I need to read all this stuff again, because I tried to do meditation for a while, and you know, I couldn't last a minute. Like your mind will wander, but come back to the breath. Yeah, no, I can't. I'm gone. Like my and this as I realized, you know, in hindsight, was a symptom of just a few years ago, like in 2019, I got an ADHD diagnosis. And some medication, and it's, you know, really changed my life in a lot of ways. But in one way was, you know, is you know, all those distracting thoughts just are gone now that I used to have all the time. And so now I think I could do it. Like, I really want to try it again, because and open up the book again, because I try to do the exercises, and I'm like, this is just way over my head. Like, there's just no way I'm going to be able to do this. But essentially, you're just, so what is meditation?
I mean, meditation, again, like I said, you could do different types of meditation, but I mean, sitting and attending to your breath. So I know, like, one of the things that we did, particularly for the dissertation, is I had the parents take their, just an app on any phone that you can download, but it's a basically takes like your breathing rate, your rate per minute for your breathing.
Oh yes, yeah, cool.
Yeah, and it was just an app. Like, you kind of hold your face against it, and you take a couple deep breaths, and it gives you like your breath rate, essentially. And one of the things I told the parents was, you know, try to lower that when you're doing mindfulness, so that, you know, when you're resting, your breath per minute is a lot lower. than when you're playing and you're talking and you're doing other things. So you want to bring your breath to that like resting state, essentially. Like right before you're about to fall asleep, or if you're like watching a really great show or a great movie, or you're sitting, you know, in front of the ocean, like that's, you know, and look at your breath, like how deeply are you breathing? Are you taking deep breaths where you're producing that like sound of like exhaling? So that was one of the first things, like when I did the training with the parents, that was one of the first things we practiced.
And so what is that focus on the breath? Like why is the breath such an important part of mindfulness and meditation? What is it about the breath that's so important?
The number of breaths per minute, like there is some research, they had done some group research on that. There is some research on the fact that like the amount of oxygen you inhale and just taking those deep breaths can reduce some of the symptoms of anxiety and even chronic pain. Like there's research on that, like just doing, but it goes beyond that. It can't just be like meditation is not going to cure by any means. There's other exercises that follow along with it that you have to continue doing. So I know we did like an 8-week course. There's body scan part that's also involved that you can do as well. Where you kind of, there's research by Nirbhav Singh on that, like the body scan component where you like different aspects of your body, you're watching like your hands, your feet, are they in that relaxation state, or, you know, are your shoulders up, like that kind of stuff. So those were also research that I looked at when I was, you know, looking to do my dissertation as well. But it's also depends on like who you ask, I feel like. It really does, because some of it come from a very medical part of it, like how that changes your brain waves and how that, you know, the oxygen itself is, you know, making a change within your body and increasing health and reducing anxiety. And then there's that mindfulness and component of the sustained attention in present moment.
So part of it's like the actual kind of physiological stuff, amount of oxygen going into the brain and kind of all that kind of thing. And, you know, deeper breaths, more oxygen, holding your breath a little bit, you know, gives it time to do its thing, and so on and so forth. But then the other part of it is, you know, in meditation is a lot about sort of, you know, trying to kind of, you know, kind of like trying to clear the mind, but really it's about trying to kind of just, you can't, the goal isn't to, you know, empty the mind, because you can't really do that. That's not going to be healthy. So the goal is instead to just, you know, acknowledge the stuff is there, but not pay much attention to it. And so you got to pay attention to something. And so the breath, because it's, you know, generally a pretty regular thing. I mean, if you're hyperventilating, maybe pick something else. It's something you can focus on. You know, some folks talk about focusing on, you know, the dot on the wall, or you know, often when you're in yoga, which I know incorporates a lot of mindfulness, you know, there's some difficult standing poses, and they really suggest, you know, focusing on a spot, you know, to sort of, you know, keep your mind clear and keep your body steady and whatnot. So it's just really just, it's almost like the metronome for meditation.
Yes. And so that one of the things, like when we looked at the effects of meditation and mindfulness and how it affects like play sessions, we did two different mindfulness sessions. So one was like where parent actually did like a 10-minute meditation with me, and they got to pick. We use, you know, there's so many apps available now. We use specific apps, and I would be on Zoom meditating with them and just looking at that breath, getting it to that resting state. And then they would go right into a play session with their child.
Gotcha.
The other one was we did like a quick preference assessment to find like visual stimuli that immediately, you know, bring about a state of calmness for people in general. Like, you know, sometimes looking at a picture of the ocean or looking at a picture of the mountains, you know, that, like, that's why people go to museums or they take pictures, you know, that. So I did a preference assessment with the parents that I had as participants, and they all each picked like a visual stimulus that happens to bring quote unquote calmness for them. And I would have that picture up and I would play a bell every 15 to 30 seconds. Mm. And when the bell played, it was like a cue for them to take a breath while they were playing with their child. Mm. Especially if like the child wasn't listening or some amount of frustration was rising because the kid was making a mess and not playing appropriately, or they wanted to switch the activity, whatever it was. And that was the other thing, you know, we went back and forth, like, do we specify that they have to engage in specific activities? And I went back and forth with my committee and I said, no, I don't want to really, I can give them suggestions, but I also don't want to limit them to doing things because then it's not child directed. What if the child decides, I don't want to play with Play-Doh today? Like, I want to play with cars. That, you know, the purpose of it is the parent understanding, like, if the child makes a choice of something different than what I want them to do, I can still be present moment and play with them, basically.
Well, let's sort of kind of get into the study now. Let's get some context on the study. So what was the point of the study? What was the goal or the questions you're asking?
The major questions was, does engaging in mindfulness meditation, does it affect parent-child interactions? So there was some of the research I looked at was parent-child interaction therapy. There is a lot of research on that. I looked at that, which is not necessarily behavior analytic, but a lot of components were very much related to behavior analysis, like how they broke down the observable behaviors, essentially. So I took some of those components, mindfulness components, and then just play in general, like how do kids from ages like 4 to 6 play? So looking at my kids, looking at, you know, just like, do they have dialogues back and forth? Not every kid does. So that was a different little bit of a variation too with the students I had. Because like I said, they were all neurotypical, but they had like learning disability or some trauma factor from childhood. Yeah. So there was definitely the addition of those factors that were not necessarily developmental delays, but factors that could affect the behavior.
They're kind of like at risk for like behavior disorders.
Yeah, sort of exactly. They were all a little bit at risk, with the exception of one. So that was another thing we looked at, like, how does that look? And the parents I chose, they happily volunteered, which was very nice, but they also wanted to learn this skill. So that was important, that they were very much bought into the 8-week training, because that's a long time. We did 2 to 3 sessions a week, which lasted anywhere from half an hour to an hour. So I needed to make sure whoever participated had that amount of time dedicated to this study. But we were looking at, like, does it increase child-parent interactions? Does it increase on-task behavior? Do the scripts look different after mindfulness? Like, are there more scripted non-scripted conversation, basically? So I didn't give them any instruction when they went into play. I was very clear, like, okay, whatever your kid chooses, you can either provide a choice of 2 or 3 things or let them just choose. And then we'll try to stick with that same item for the session. And it was a 10-minute session. A long session by any means, but that was really the goal, is to look at those components and then figure out where we can take this research further, basically.
So parent-child interactions, that makes me think of Jerry Patterson from my background. Gerald Patterson, you know that name? If, just a second here, I'm just going to look at I got your thesis open, your dissertation open here. Oh, you have him as a reference.
I do have him as a reference.
Patterson, sure. Patterson, DeBarish, and Ramsey, 1999.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. Because I had Joel Lucician on. I don't know if you know that name, on the podcast a while back. He was my thesis supervisor.
Okay.
And Joe's the behavior disorder guy at University of British Columbia in kind of my neck of the woods. And Joe is he kind of did his work in Oregon with like Rob Horner and those guys, you know, the early PBSers. And so Joe is one of these early PBS guys. But he also for 40 years, he's been a Zen master. So he's like meditating every day, like all the time. And he did like meditation classes for us, like while we were in there and stuff. And and he does a lot of his research is on parent-child interactions, and he uses Jerry Patterson talks about the I think it was called the coercive parent-child interaction process thing, where, you know, essentially negative reinforcement, you know, I'll give you what you want so you'll stop, you know, you'll stop pissing me off, and then I'll calm down, and that's my reinforcement. And any sort of used, you know, PBS, ABA, but also some mindfulness and stuff, I think, as well, to sort of, you know, rewrite those interactions and improve kind of parent interactions. And so there's a lot of really cool research from Jerry Patterson and others, I think, on this sort of parent interaction model. And, it is really central to kind of a lot of what behavior analysts do. We're trying to sort of change the behavior of the people working with the individuals, not so much the individuals themselves. Trying to kind of break those cycles. So I get it's pretty understandable why you want to improve parent-child interactions. Why this play skill focus, and what is it about play skills that you wanted to?
That's a
why are play skills important?
And
before you answer this, I asked this question from a very biased perspective. As a kid,
okay,
I don't really think I had a lot of high-end play skills. You know, I was very much for most of my childhood I had a couple friends, we did a couple things, but even with them I was much more of a parallel player and a solo player versus a let's play together kind of thing. You know, I think I look at sort of, and this is one of my criticisms of sort of early intervention, is this kind of focus on the right way to play. And again, this is that kind of Western colonial perspective coming in. It's often playing these, you know, these neurotypic gender specific games or activities. You know, it's about, you know, eye contact and, you know, turn taking and, you know, all these things, you know, in order to sort of, you know, successfully, you know, play Connect Four or something. And, you know, once this kid's really good at Connect Four, well, our study's over, and you know, now we've got a kid who's, you know, super self-conscious whenever he plays Connect Four because he's got to follow all these rules that he learned. So why the focus on play skills? What are play skills?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like how do you do all that?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And it's funny that you say that with the teaching of the rules and the connector. Well, that was one of the first reasons why I wanted to do play skills. Originally, I wanted to do like an academic task, to be honest. And then I changed it to play skills when we shifted gear to training more of the parents, because we were doing more of the learning of specific academic skill or even a receptive or language skill than when we would need to have the child as the participant, not the parent. And I wanted to, one, you know, IRB approval obviously is always a challenge with any research you do. You know, so I wanted to avoid, because I learned a lesson from my thesis that, you know, when you use children as participants, it goes it's a lot more involved, first of all.
Right.
When you're doing direct research and collecting data on children, recording them, and all of that. Mm. And I wanted to avoid some of the barriers that I faced, first of all, with the pieces in that aspect. But the other part of it was play skills in general, just working across like early intervention, public school setting, private school settings, just play skills, the way they get taught, I feel is so rigid and so like rule-based. And yes, you need to have some rule-governed contingencies in place, but I think it can also just be about the play itself and not necessarily like one kid might play this way, but the other kid might not. And that's okay too. And they don't have to give you, they don't have to look at you to involve you in the play, or they don't have to say specific things. You, what are the nonverbal things that kids do that looks like they're involving you in play? So even if somebody's playing with you parallel, doesn't mean they don't want to play with you. They just don't want to share or take turns necessarily.
Right. Yeah, so, exactly.
So looking at it from that perspective too, like it's okay to play parallel. That's not a big deal. And if kids who play parallel, if it's a goal for them to make more friends, then, or something that they find isolating for themselves, then that's a different story. They're playing parallel and they're still engaging. And if a kid comes over and says, can I borrow that? And they're able to do so without, you know, completely losing their cool, essentially. That's what's important. Not that they go back and forth.
Right.
Because I know adults who can't share. So, you know, so the constant pushing of children to share all the time is also not necessarily necessary. Because the play itself becomes aversive.
Right. So what was the problem you're trying to solve? I know that you told me the question, but what was, you know, I guess what was sort of the before and after maybe with these families?
Yeah, I think the before was, you know, one of the surveys that we did was, you know, how often do you just like join in when your child is playing? Most parents, it's, you know, it's after a certain age, especially when your kid is after a certain age, a lot of the times you say, all right, go play.
Yeah.
And they're on their own and they're playing.
Yeah.
And they're out of your hair and you're not worried about them, essentially. And it's a behavior we constantly want to increase, but we don't then reinforce when the kids are actually doing this. But it's constantly a behavior that parents want the kids to engage in. But it's like, okay, like the playing itself is a reinforcer, but then your attention is a higher reinforcer in a lot of ways. And in a lot of situations it is, because when you send a child off to play, within a few minutes, they'll come back and there will be some sort of issue. And I know this from just my own children on having them play individually and having them play parallel and collaboratively, just looking at how their play skills have developed too. So some hands-on experience on my end for sure, like mistakes to avoid possibly. But yeah, so that was the goal, is to talk to parents. And, you know, a lot of the parents say like, yeah, I don't really like when my kid is playing, I'm watching them play or making sure they're safe, but I'm not really enjoying or joining in to the play. So a lot of the research on parent-child interaction also talked about like the positive interaction in early childhood and how those interactions really lead to like more self-determined, self-reliant adults, essentially. So like understanding those components, and I wanted to look at that a little bit further, like parents who don't traditionally join in play or who don't maybe have these interactions outside of like telling your child to do something. Like most of parent interactions after a certain age becomes about telling them to do something.
Yeah.
And reinforcement comes after you've told them to do that, and then they do it the way you ask them to do it. So we wanted to look at a little bit different aspects of how free, like almost like a free operant parent-child interaction in a sense, like how that can also be reinforcing, and like the child then builds this relationship with you that's outside of viewing you as just somebody who's coming in and placing demands, essentially.
Well, and often it seems that this go play sort of command is related to not wanting to play,
right?
By the parents, right? You know, I need a break from you, you know, because I want to, you know, do something else. The second secret word is India. I need you to kind of go play. And now, and sort of this day and age, go play is often just go get the device.
Yes.
Right. And it might even be go play right here in front of me while I'm doing my chore, but don't talk to me. Mm-hmm. So these families that came in, these were all families that, you know, maybe didn't play as much or didn't engage as much, but were interested in doing more.
Yeah. So the families that, you know, they definitely wanted, or they wanted to enjoy that play more, or so the social validity component was definitely more important to me than the other aspects of it. Of like I've had, after we did the interventions, I've had parents play to tell me, like, I just went out and played with my kids in the rain for an hour and I've never done that before. It was something I would even think to do. So I wanted to look at that. Like, how did you start to enjoy the interactions with your child more? Do you feel like your parenting sense of competency increased and that you're looking at sort of like the world from your child's point of view rather than your point of view? So that was like the bigger picture. But I needed to word it in a way that was still behavior analytic and looked at the observable behaviors too.
And so was it that they just, you know, didn't know how to play, or like what was sort of the barrier for them to just go play with their kids? Why did they need to be in the study?
So one of the pre-assessment or their initial involvement was, one, we wanted parents with children of a certain age, and we wanted parents who were interested in learning how to play with their kids without, one thing, it would be different if I could show you the baseline videos, because it's very different. Like when I looked at them in baseline, this is pre-intervention, we've not done any mindfulness, when they would play, there wasn't a lot of back and forth, or the kid would be turned away from them and not really talking to the parent. Or, you know, it wasn't, you could tell the parent was not as interested in what the kid was doing. So a lot of those components. But, and then after the mindfulness interventions, like one of the data that we, like when I looked at the data, one of the things we found was the back and forth interactions, the number of child interactions increased after mindfulness for every single participant. So the kid was much more interested in involving the parent and talking, engaging back and forth after mindfulness sessions.
And so were you teaching, obviously there's the mindfulness component, but were you teaching play skills as well?
No, we did not directly, like in the dissertation itself or in the research itself, there was no direct training of play skills happening. It was literally looking at, like, does engaging in mindfulness before you play with your child, does that change that whole interaction?
And so in baseline, you know, you're watching these videos.
Yeah.
Was it that they would sort of, you know, try for a couple of minutes and then just give up and say, like, I don't know what I'm doing.
Or like a parent would like get distracted by their phone or something else that was going on. And what we were trying to do is make it also feasible for, you know, so we weren't saying like you need to now play for a half an hour with your kid, but let's start with like a 10-minute session.
Gotcha.
If that also affects your day-to-day interactions with your child beyond the play session too.
Right. Right.
And that was more of a social validity component, not direct data, but that was another factor that we found parents felt that their interactions with their kid throughout the day outside of the play sessions were better too.
All right, in a second, I want to kind of get into exactly what you did, like what the 8 weeks looked like and all that.
Right.
but I want to step out for a second and talk about ACT for a second. So ACT, acceptance commitment therapy, acceptance commitment training, been around forever. Starting to get some more headway for behavior analysts. And ACT is, you know, it's got essentially these kind of six components in there, the hexaflex, they call it, or whatever. And, and ACT is all about, you know, the private, internal kind of verbal behavior. So how you talk in your head. We think about people who are really stuck in their head or really overthinking, or we talked about anxiety earlier. ACT is sort of meant for those folks to kind of, you know, change those internal kind of verbal pathways. And a component of ACT is this, or one of those things, and I'm not an ACT person, but is around being in the present moment. So it's got a mindfulness kind of component to it. But you're just doing mindfulness. You weren't doing any of the other stuff. So you weren't looking at sort of what they were thinking about in their heads during this process. You weren't, you know, giving them any.
Yeah. Yeah. That was another area where I thought like maybe we could incorporate that. And there's more things that exist now that tells you like when you're, like the Muse bands and those things, we looked into that. And I thought that it took away from what I wanted to look at. I wanted to keep it very simple and straightforward and not get into complex private events or ACT. I wanted to keep the focus simply on mindfulness and whether engaging in these simple 10-minute sessions or even having some sort of reminder to take a deep breath like that. Auditory sound or the visual stimulus, does that, just doing that alone, does that have a benefit without getting more into the more complex areas of like, now you go do homework and like, so there was no, you know, I asked parents, I said, as much as you can, if you can do even 5 minutes of mindful meditation or, you know, sit and look at that visual stimulus for 2 minutes before you go to work, like whatever it is that you can do throughout the day. But there was none of that homework component that like other research has incorporated when they train parents on specific mindfulness interventions.
So what did you do with these parents? What was the program you put them in through?
it was very simple. Honestly, I tried to keep it so that I wasn't going to lose participants. I wasn't going to make it challenging for these parents. We're all working parents.
Yep.
You know, every single participant that I had was a working mom. I had one parent who was a part-time worker, but did a lot of like things for her community. So that was another component. We wanted to have parents that had other responsibility and other children. So it wasn't just like, oh, I have this one child and life is beautiful because this is the only child I have to worry about. That was another component of that. Like, do they have siblings? Are you a working parent? Do you work a 40-hour work week? You know, what are the responsibilities other than your children do you have? And all four participants had like jobs and other responsibilities.
Yeah.
So that was a nice factor. The only factor I would say is the demographics was limited for my study. So I had all four were women, all Caucasian, and from like middle class suburban families. So one component I would like to look at in the future is other demographics. Like, is this really feasible for, you know, other single moms? Like, for example. Right. It would have been cool to have a parent who was a single parent because, you know, with research, obviously you can only take in the people who give consent and who want to actually participate. So we weren't able to get any of those participants. And that was that's definitely an area I want to look at further. Just how does this translate to somebody who maybe doesn't even have the some of the resources that these families had?
Yeah. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you said it was simple. So what was it? What did you do?
I forgot. You asked that question. It was simple. So they basically, it was over Zoom. In person was not feasible as much. And this was I started research right after the pandemic. So there was limitations with the in-person going into somebody 3 times a week. It was definitely not feasible. And they were all over New Jersey. So that was me working full-time and going to school was not going to be feasible for me to do that either. So we did a 10-minute mindfulness session. So it was, I randomized. So one day was either the mindful bell with the visual stimulus. And then the next session was with mindful meditation for the first 10 minutes and then going into a play session. So, and that's really, I was on Zoom and I would do the meditation with the parent. They had the option if their child wanted to join, the child could. I had one or two sessions where a child joined and definitely not as smooth for, and then they would just go right into play. And then when they went into play, the only instruction I gave was, you know, if you want to have like the play area set up beforehand, that's fine. If you don't, but what I would do is like limit it to 2 or 3 activities so that we're not jumping from one activity to another, which would have been harder to evaluate if the child had free choice, essentially. So that was really the only instruction. And then I would just continuously, every 15 seconds, I was scoring across 6 different responses. If that was something, if they were on task, if there was an interaction that happened, did the child look at the parent and smile? Did the parent smile back? You know, did the parent provide any verbal praise? We're looking at that. So praise statement being praised for the parents after mindfulness too. So that was nice.
This brings back some trauma. He says somewhat sarcastically. No. I shouldn't use the word trauma. I'm wasting it on this topic, this point. But I'm just thinking about the coding, because I was doing some RA stuff and I was helping one of Joe's students who was studying parent-child interactions, and you know, the coding for parent-child interactions is ridiculous. And he was doing, I think he had like 10-second, you know, intervals, and you know, there was like 10 different things to code for in each 10-second interval, you know, and so the IOA was...
The IOA was not fun. I have to say the people who helped me with IOA, I give them so much credit. It's one of my close friends who also needed help with IOA. Yeah, she helped me out, but it was not fun doing
it. For those who don't know, IOA, inter-observer agreement, essentially in a lot of these observational studies, you want to make sure that multiple people observe whatever you're observing to ensure that, you know, there kind of removes some of the bias, ensures that, you know, everyone's seeing the same thing and describing the same thing, ensures that you're, you know, it just gives you kind of more control. And so, and so basically three, you know, it's easy if you're just sort of, you know, looking at one thing, you know, did they eat their dinner or not? You know, they ate it. Check. Okay. IOA 100%. But when you're looking at interactions, there's just so many little bits in there. So what was your IOA?
Luckily I had 80% and above agreement. We did have to do some training IOA, and then I had to do the real IOA. We had to do like training across 1 or 2 sessions before IOA was clearly in agreement across the sessions. I think the most difficult to code was the interactions or, you know, reinforcement statements. Because if a parent was like, oh, I like playing with you, could that count as an interaction? Could that count as a reinforcement statement? Like, do we want to count that in that 15
right.
seconds?
Right.
So I had to specify those responses very, very detailed. It needed to be very detailed, essentially. What is an interaction versus what is a reinforcement statement?
Yeah, gotcha. And so for the 8 weeks, all they were doing was either the 10, so that was 10 minutes. And so was that 10 minutes of meditation? So basically sitting there for 10 minutes and doing the thing?
Or Zoom with me.
Did you work your way up to 10 minutes? Because I know 10 minutes, I still can't get to 10 minutes. you know, I was, there was an app, I don't know if it's still around, that I used called 1 Minute Meditation. And it was this British guy with a super calm voice taking you through this 1 minute meditation. And, you know, and when it ended, you had that, probably the similar gong bell sound that you talk about that brings you so much peace. It brought me peace because I knew it was over. but the idea of getting, I think one time I made it to 5 minutes and I was like, you know, my brain can't do this anymore. So was it 10 minutes from the beginning?
Yeah, it was 10 minutes from the beginning once they went into the intervention, because it would have been challenging for us to do it where we systematically increase the interval. And I did ask the parents, I said, is 10 minutes too long? But the nice part of it was every time we met, it wasn't a 10 minute meditation, because the other intervention that we did was they were just doing the play session while I played the bell, and the bell, the visual and the visual stimulus was somewhere in the room where they could quickly look at it. And then the sound of the bell was just an indication or prompt, really, to just take a deep breath. Their mind was wandering too much off of what they were doing.
Gotcha.
So, I mean, the parents liked it only because it gave them that 10 minutes to just sit and do nothing, which was nice, honestly. Yep. That was another feedback that I got. They were like, oh, I just get to sit for 10 minutes and just do deep breathing with you. Yeah, I'm all for that.
Nice. Yeah. And of course, they could be thinking about whatever they wanted. Right.
Yes.
Yeah. So you actually don't really know how mindful they were being, per se. No. Like, you don't know how focused they were on the breath and on the present moment and all that kind of stuff. All you know is for 10 minutes, they sat there, didn't say anything, maybe had their eyes closed.
Yep.
And then, so as soon as that 10 minutes was over, did they then go play?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A quick 30-second break, and then they would get their child and go right into play.
And then, how did the bell work? So was the bell on a regular timer, or was it you sort of ringing the bell whenever you saw them getting psychedelic?
No, it was on a like a 10 to 15 second, like a variable.
Right, kind of schedule or whatever.
So over Zoom, like I have an app that has a mindful bell, and I would just play it over Zoom.
Right. Gotcha. They were taking a breath every 10 to 15 seconds through the whole play session.
Right, and it wasn't like I'm doing it in response to you possibly wandering, your thoughts are wandering, or you're not seeming to be engaging. It would play regardless.
Right.
Yeah.
And then how long was the play session? Did it vary? It was 10 minutes. And so what happened after 10 minutes? Did they just stop playing, or you just stopped taking data?
I just stopped taking data. So like most parents would continue a little bit longer, you know, the parent would either talk to me afterwards and check in like, all right, how'd that feel? So a lot of that, you know, again, subjective data, but data that was important for me from a social validity perspective. You know, every parent after the 10-minute mindfulness session always told me that felt great, that it was it was so nice to just not be thinking. And one thing I would tell them is like, try to let your thoughts pass by. If you're thinking about what you need to do after you're done with me, you know, let that be there, but don't let it, you know, bother you, and let it pass by. And we did do the breath rate. So most parents, like if their breath rate was at like 16 or 17 after the 10-minute mindfulness session, it would go down to like an 8 or a 9 across the board. So that was
that like per minute kind of thing, or?
Yeah. So it's like breath per minute. It's on like a Google app that I had. I'm sure it's other apps.
Well, the reason I ask is I know in like first aid courses, they tell you sort of a normal respiration rate is like 12 to 20 breaths a minute.
Yeah.
And so, but you were getting them down to 8 or 9.
Yeah. And it wouldn't happen every time necessarily. And that was not data that I included, but you know, it's anecdotal data that I have just to see like, is your resting breath rate versus like your normal breath rate.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to look at some of those other sort of physiological kind of responses, do you know what a pulse oximeter is?
No.
Yeah, that's cool. They're cool. So those are those little finger things.
Oh, those finger things. I was just going to say that the finger thing.
You clip it on the finger. Yes. It gives you a heart rate. Yep. And it gives you, I think, heart rate and blood oxygen level.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So you could actually. It's interesting. I've seen it work. When I'm not doing all this stuff, I'm a volunteer firefighter and first responder, and so we've gone in with we'll go in and maybe the patient put this pulse oximeter on their finger kind of right away and to check things, and essentially if their oxygen level is below your blood oxygen level should be like 99-100%. You should have that's sort of the, you know, I don't know what that means exactly, like how much it is, but that's sort of a good level. And if it drops below 95, then, you know, there's problems below 90, big problems in terms of you're just not getting enough oxygen. And so you'll put them on oxygen. And so we'll give them an oxygen tank, put a mask on them, breathe, and you'll watch that number kind of shoot up right away. But we also have noticed that, you know, if we ask them to take deep breaths, that the blood oxygen level will go up, because you know they're taking in more oxygen. Right. So it would be interesting to sort of measure those things, to measure heart rate and see if that goes kind of up and down, sort of in the moment, to kind of see how mindfulness kind of plays.
Yeah, I have a somebody else who was in my cohort was doing similar research, but she was going to use the Muse bands, which calculates data, like brainwaves data.
Oh yeah, there's a bunch of those. I forgot about there's so many more body metric devices, right?
Right, exactly. And I wanted to do something like that, but I felt like that would have been more feasible to do if I was doing like in-person sessions.
Right, yeah.
A lot more accuracy with that. And so that's why we kind of like nixed that idea, because I'm like, I can't see this person physically. It's... I don't know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Even accurate, you know.
So, why was the 8 weeks about just getting enough data, or like why 8 weeks?
So the 8 week came from previous research when we were meeting. When I was meeting with my committee, they were asking like, how long do you want to, you know? They said 4 weeks might be too short. I mean, typically for a dissertation, you have to have some certain amount of data regardless. And then there's some stipulations on like how many sessions you need to have and all that, but I picked the 8 week because in the John Kabat-Zinn research and like even the other research on mindfulness by Nirbhav Singh, there seems to be like the 8 week component seems to be consistent across a lot of those research. So, you know, after speaking with my committee, we decided to keep that consistent. I would have liked to do like a follow-up, which I did not get to do, unfortunately. That was another component that I would have liked to do.
That was my next question. Yeah, like, are they still doing it?
Yeah,
how's that going?
Send out a survey and see if they're still doing it. I've actually considered doing that because the dissertation ended early last year. So, you know, it's been almost a year at this point.
Yeah, you totally could. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I totally could send out a quick survey to my participants and ask, like,
that'd be awesome.
Good practice. And it would just be a simple yes or no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And keep doing it. That's what Joe does. So Joe Lucician does a lot of this long-term follow-up research. So he does a year, 3 years, 7 years, 10 years. I think he's done a 12 year data point. And he just that's all, you know, just kind of goes and checks in a year later and takes it down, you know, watches the session and sees where they're at. And really good. And who was it? Denny Reed, you know, he's the staff training guy. He did a 30-year data point. Yeah, for something. So yeah, it's neat if you can think to kind of go back. That'd be cool. So did all of them do better?
Yeah, overall, definitely. I mean, based on what I saw, like there wasn't a huge difference across everything we looked at, which was, you know, again, but like the point of research is not always to get positive results, right? Doing it, one, because you enjoy it, hopefully, and two, you want to just look at, is there any effects? And even if you have data that you didn't necessarily go in the way that you wanted, that still gives you information, I feel. So like the parent involvement component, like involving parent in play, like the child involving the parent in play went up across the board for everybody. And then the scripted statements. But like the on task was always high. So like, because I think the parents were being observed, even though I didn't give this as a instruction or anything, I didn't say like, you can't look at your phone or you can't have other tasks that might be happening. It was parents on their own just did not become distracted.
Right.
We had a couple of sessions where a second sibling would join in, and that led to distractions on the end of the parent. Like it reduced how much they were interacting with the child who was the participant.
Yeah.
Compared to the child who came into the room halfway through the session and started asking questions.
Yeah.
That happened a couple of times.
So you keep referring to a couple folks who have done some research in this area. So who are they?
I mean, the few that I've like looked at a lot, and I'm sure there's more, like there, I've looked at some of their research. John Kabat-Zinn was definitely a big one. There's a lot of research by Nirbhav Singh in this area, because he's done a lot of research, like specifically in like educational settings, on reducing, like doing like classroom wide class management strategies. He's done some parent training in this area. But you know, a lot of the data that existed was like data collected by the parent themselves. And then there was a lot of like pre-training and post-training, and it was much more involved. So I took all the components of like what they had done and tried to make it more simplistic in a way, but straightforward, but also looking at like important factors that I wanted to look at, essentially.
Right. Like Dr. Singh, is he like the only behavior analyst that's researching mindfulness, or is there anybody else?
I feel like he is. Yeah. I mean, like I know, and like a lot of the guys who are doing ACT, and there's definitely a lot of mindfulness research
in there. But specific to mindfulness. He seems to be the guy. So what do you want to do next with this research?
Loaded question.
with mindfulness anyway.
You know, I'm trying to incorporate it for like the learners that I work with now. So I have a few learners. They have a specific mindfulness program where they do either deep breathing exercises for like 2 minutes. And then we go and do a task right after that's challenging, or, you know, it's typically difficult for the child. And then we see like, okay, are they able to perform the task at more ease? Are they able to tolerate the demands? So we're looking at that, not like in a very experimental analysis kind of way, but more of like from looking at it from like a service provider point of view, because you know, day to day, you do so many different things, and you're not like necessarily doing it to publish research or like even like the in-depth research of it. But I'm looking at it probably more anecdotally, but based in the sense that we collect data on those things for our own purpose. Now, there's no like set plans to do more research in this area, but I do want to start. So I've done social skills group, for example, where I've incorporated mindfulness. I had students who were high school age students who have an IEP, but are in a gen ed setting. and have lots of difficulties with making friends or sustaining friendships or anxiety in other areas. Like, so we incorporated mindfulness into the social skills.
Nice.
Yeah. And then we would go right into like journal writing. Either the kids would tell me verbally like how they felt during it, or they would write it down. It was really their choice. Hmm. So I'm slowly trying to incorporate it into like daily practice with the kids that I work with directly. Cool. And training staff on how to incorporate it, essentially, is my next goal. It's like, how do I train BCBAs to have this as a goal, and how do we incorporate it and not make it so that it doesn't have to be so complex? Like, we could just take duration-based data on like, how long is the child able to meditate or sit still and focus, and then let's start there.
Yeah. Cool.
How can we build this into their daily practice, essentially?
Yeah. And what about just in general? What do you want to be doing in the next few years?
Well, I'm working with a clinic right now, and you know, I hope to continue with them. I know they have projections to opening more clinics, so I want to, you know, support that. It's young people in the field who really want to, you know, increase the opportunity for services, and you know, I'm all about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, my goal is to just continue doing what I'm doing. And then hopefully one of the areas where I would really like to do is create like a play-based skills assessment, but incorporating some mindfulness components eventually.
Do they have like play-based skill assessments in general, or?
They do.
Like, what is there like a well-known one that would just sort of give me some context, or no?
I mean, like the ones I've used, like BBMAP,
they have. Oh, okay. I see.
You know, like, I've used that, but I want to go a little bit, you know, beyond what's already available. Like, they're socially savvy. I've used that. I like that. Yeah. But I also want to think about like just child development in general, and
nice.
Like courses that BCBAs don't really get taught. Like, most BCBAs don't have child development coursework in their courses, which I think is weird, to be honest.
Yep.
Like, agreed. That's a big component of what we're doing. Like, we're learning about it.
Yeah.
So I learned about it in undergrad as a special education teacher.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, I want to continue, like, even if I can go to more conferences just on those areas.
Yeah, that's cool.
Putting my focus into.
The third secret word is meditation. Right on. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, good stuff. Yeah, neat work, Pranali. I love it.
Thanks, Ben.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. This was awesome. And definitely very relaxing.
Yeah, good. Yeah, that's perfect. We're zenning it up.
We're totally zen. Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Cool.
I didn't feel nervous at all. So that was
perfect. Awesome. Yeah. All right, we'll see you later.
Yeah, I'll see you soon. Thank you so much.